Whether you're making the same breakfast that you have every day or baking a cake for an extra special day, eggs are a staple in our diets. Eggland's Best eggs are nutritionally superior to ordinary eggs, containing more vitamins and 25% less saturated fat. Not only are they better for you, but Eggland's Best eggs taste better too. There's a reason that they're America's number one eggs. Visit egglandsbest.com for additional information and delicious recipes.
Screen Time with John Fardy.
Thanks to Eritainment, a new era in Irish streaming begins. Discover more at eritainment.com.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy. This is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, Fiona Shaw chats about her new Netflix Christmas movie, That Christmas, as well as her long and varied acting career with everything from Three Men and a Little Lady all the way up to Harry Potter and Andor. And I talk to the legendary screenwriter and director Richard Curtis about writing That Christmas, as well as Four Weddings and a Funeral and lots more besides. And we review Night Bitch. Amy Adams takes on pathological motherhood. Neve O'Reilly reviews. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all. There was no show last week because we were in the middle of a general election. And indeed, I was sent to a count centre in Louth where I spent the entire weekend from 8 a.m. till midnight Saturday and indeed Sunday. And only two people had been elected by that stage. You know, Christy Moore says it best, when the elections are all over, we'll all be pushing up clover. An election count centre, to my mind, and I've been and worked at a few of them, is a bit like a long haul flight or even a hospital ward. It's like the only thing you can see is this place you're in, and you're kind of dying to get out of it. Now, that said, the atmosphere is very convivial, and all the political parties, certainly in the ones I've been in, tend to get on very well because there's a sense of, you know, we'll kill each other before and after this, but we're kind of all in it together. And even rival national radio stations get on very well and offer you free pizza and stuff like that. And a special hello to Shane McGowan from Radio One. But yes, it was full on. It was exhausting, but not without its entertainments, I have to say. So that was me last weekend in a count centre near you. Now, in TV this week, I was watching this.
When I said to lay low, what did that mean to you exactly?
I did lay low. I met a ton of people, but I was very discreet, blended right in.
There's an entire pizza stuck to your back.
Oh. Thank God, I'm starving. Oh. So, I do have a report. Smoked a little grass last night. Mm. Just to be part of the group. Would have been suspicious if I didn't.
I'm sorry, is that your report?
Yeah. This place is insane. It's like high school. I never expected this. It's like all the people here are, you know, they're cliquey and they're rowdy and they're horny. Somebody asked me out on a date last night. But who?
Now, that is a clip from A Man on the Inside. You heard Ted Danson there, waking up with a hangover. This is on Netflix. It landed last week, I think it was. And it's from Michael Shore, the man who gave us The Good Place, that very sweet TV show about kind of getting into heaven on Netflix. He also took over the writing on Parks and Recreations. And he kind of does nice TV. There's a pleasantness to it. And this is no exception. And what we have the great Ted Danson on fine, fine form. And in a way, there is a similarity between The Good Place because Ted Danson is playing a nice guy. He's someone who's recently enough bereaved, and he sees an ad in a newspaper about helping out a detective agency who want to investigate a crime, a pretty small crime of jewels and necklaces going missing in a retirement community. And he gets the gig and he joins this retirement community to try and investigate the various people who may be at risk. But of course, you can kind of see it coming. He finds a huge amount of connection in this retirement home. It's a pretty fancy one in San Francisco, and San Francisco looms large in this. And we've lots of panoramic shots of the Golden Gate Bridge and things like that. And he starts to befriend people, possibly reconnect and find purpose. If you've ever read any of the series of the books, The Thursday Murder Club, this is certain vibe to that in it, a bit like Only Murders in the Building as well, in that you have, I suppose, slightly older people trying to find purpose in their lives, be it through a crime or something like that. This is lovely. It's absolutely delightful. It's very gentle in lots of ways. What I also love about it is it's peopled with all these character actors opposite Ted Danson, who are too many to name, but you will recognize from everything from Orange is the New Black to these kind of largely American actors you've been watching for years in film and TV and going, oh, he's the guy from, she's the guy from it. There's a brilliant supporting cast here. Ted Danson is brilliant in it. And what I really like about it is it's sweet, but it does go a little deeper as the show goes on. Ted Danson's wife died from complications due to dementia, and that becomes kind of a more engulfing storyline as the series goes on, and it gets really sad at times, but beautiful as well. I really like this. A Man on the Inside on Netflix. Ted Danson playing an aging detective of sorts in a retirement community. Absolutely delightful. Do let me know if you might have watched it. John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com and let me know what you might have been watching in the cinema, if you've been to Gladiator 2, if you've watched Say Nothing on Disney, which people are still getting in touch with me about. Now, it is December, so I'm allowed to talk about Christmas.
This is the tale of one of the most challenging nights of my long career.
Chance, you won't get all those sacks down the chimney in one go.
Christmas was knocking on Wellington's front door.
Come on out! Out!
And here are our unfortunate heroes.
Bernadette, you're in charge.
Yes! 8 kid-free hours!
Oh, hi, Danny.
Hi, Sam.
Oh, you've ruined Christmas lunch for everyone.
Except the turkeys.
Yeah. Your dad be here in an hour. I bet with more presents than Santa. See ya.
Dad.
Oh. All the snow.
If you thought the snow was over, you were wrong.
Now, that is a clip from That Christmas, a new animated movie that lands on Netflix this week. It was out on Wednesday, and it's based on the series of successful children's books from the great Richard Curtis, who co-wrote this script along with Simon Otto, who directed this and who gave us the How to Train Your Dragon trilogy. This is the first time Richard Curtis has been involved in animation. That Christmas follows a series of intertwined tales about, I suppose, love, loneliness, family and friendship, and Santa Claus making a big mistake. There's also a few turkeys in it. The setting is the fictional seaside village of Wellington-on-Sea, kind of picturesque houses and very similar to a town Richard Curtis has a house in or lives in. A close-knit bunch of families living together experience a Christmas crisis due to a blizzard, which is paralyzing traffic, making it very difficult for the airborne Santa, voiced by Brian Cox, to see. He's actually finding it hard to see as he whooshes around trying to deliver presents. A lonely boy living with a single mother worries that he won't see his divorced dad. We've two identical twin girls on the naughty list, on the nice list, experiencing a crisis when Santa muddles them up. We've a stern teacher voiced by Fiona Shaw, who has her own private sadnesses and vulnerabilities. There's a talented, headstrong girl who takes charge of the kids who are kind of left when their parents are stranded due to the snow. So there's a couple of intertwined stories around Christmas and children and parents going on. So there isn't one protagonist, there's a few. It's lovely. It's called That Christmas. Really enjoyed it. I've said to you, if you're a regular listener to this show, that, you know, Christmas movies, an awful lot of them aren't very good. I think this is a lovely Christmas movie. A little sad at times, but I think that's okay. My 6-year-old watched it. He did find it a bit sad, but we'll get to that because the stern school principal is voiced by the brilliant Fiona Shaw, star of stage and screen and TV from, you know, if you want to go in reverse order, she was recently in Andor, famously in the Harry Potter movies, all the way back to Three Men and a Little Lady from Cork, of course, and has done all sorts of Shakespeare and Carnegie Hall appearances, an acting legend. So I got to talk to her about her role, her voice role in That Christmas, and plenty more besides.
Hello, John.
Hello, Fiona. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. And I hope you are too.
I am. All the better for seeing you. I spoke to you for Enola Holmes a good few years ago.
Yes.
Let me get straight to it. I was surprised and I suppose heartened by how kind of sad this is at times. So our protagonist is missing his dad. Your own character, Miss Trapper, has some melancholy from the past. Like, you know, and my wife watched it with me and she was like, oh, I'm not sure I want to show this to our six-year-old. It's a little too sad. And I was saying, no, this is good. Where do you stand on the sadness in it? Because it is a kid's movie, but...
I'm with you. I'm rather heartened by it not being some saccharine version of perfection that that no family or life or community could ever achieve. So I loved that it was about people having very mild difficulties. I think your six-year-old would enjoy it because the kids go out and play and they fall and they do angel wings and snow, but their day has gone a little bit wrong, but not catastrophically wrong. The parents get trapped in their car. And I think it's a really, really good, it's an investigation, isn't it, into that day rather than the story of the day.
Yeah.
And I think it's a very good film for that reason. Like you, I was really pleasantly surprised.
Yeah. And I wonder when it comes to, you know, voice acting, like, do you see it as, I don't know, not a break from acting, but I suppose the idea you can go along in your pajamas to the recording studio or something like that. Not that I'm sure you do, but is it a very different experience to being on a set with actors? I mean, I'm assuming it is, but I presume you have to get into a completely different headspace.
It's fundamentally different. You're just obedient. They've done all the work. They make the characters, they draw them, they make them move, they decide on the rhythm of them, and you just paint the last lick of paint of the voice of the character. It's not negotiable. It's already done. And you get invited back for them to fix it or fix or adjust something that they've done. But usually, you know, with great heart, presumably they've also had to, they have to unify all the voices together, but we don't meet, of course, but the voices, the timbre of the voices has to be adjusted by them. So really you just play with what you're seeing on the screen. That's all you're doing.
Yeah.
It's fundamentally different. They've done 99% of it, really.
Yeah, and you're obedient, which leads me to believe you're not on other sets. But anyway,
your job isn't to be obedient to other sets. Your job is to try and respond and make something come through your body and your costume and your hair and your makeup and your being. But that's not what you're being asked to do. So you are very free and you absolutely could turn up in your pajamas.
Yeah. Do you have very happy memories or otherwise of Christmas growing up in Cork?
I have so many memories of Christmas because I'm so old that there's millions of memories.
Are they happy?
They were. Yeah. I mean, we as a family, we you know, around the Christmas table, my great aunts, my granny, all that went on, very traditional, all through my early life. And then when I went away to RADA and my brothers also went away, they live in France, we would all go back to Cork for Christmas. And then more lately, my mother's still alive, we would go to France where my brothers are for Christmas, or they would come to me in London for Christmas since my dad died. So I have many, many Christmases, but my traditional Cork Christmases were always very good fun because a lot of people went away, particularly students, they went away and then they came back at Christmas. A lot of community, actually. Much more about community than about just family, you know.
Lovely. And I presume you hope people might watch this on Christmas Day or Christmas Eve or something like that. Because despite me saying this stuff about, you know, the sad themes in it as well, it's very, very Christmassy. I mean, the clue's in the title. But I mean, it'd be lovely to think people might watch this Christmas Eve before Santa came.
I think it's lovely, and I love that Santa's in it. I was a great fan of Santa. I just adored Santa. So I'm a big fan of Santa. I love the Santa, and this film only has one reindeer. That was hilarious. But I think Santa is the most brilliant fact of Christmas.
Yes, I completely agree with you. As a father of three, a fact, a scientific fact.
Yeah.
Just reflecting on all you've done, and I was thinking about Three Men and a Little Lady, right? That was 1990, to take you back to then. I'm just wondering, at the time, did you have a sense, wow, I'm going to Hollywood, or I'm in Hollywood, this is incredible? Or was it just a gig at the time that you got? Because that would have been the first time I ever saw you on screen.
That's 34 years ago. I was, at that time, I just played Electra at the Royal Shakespeare Company, and that was what was on my mind.
Okay.
And then I was asked to do Three Men and a Lady, and it was just a holiday job. That's all it was. I mean, that's the amazing thing, is that the experience of the actor is quite different to the experience of the audience. If you're in something that is absolutely all over the world, you know, like Harry Potter, you have no sense of it when you're doing it. I was much more involved in what I was doing in the theatre than Three Men and a Lady. But
It's funny you say that, because when I spoke to you for Enola Holmes, I mentioned HP, and I've quoted you subsequently to other actors because it was a very clever answer. You said, you know, basically the same thing. I've been on stages all over the world and in all sorts of things. And yet I do a couple of days every few films as Mrs. Dudsley. And everywhere I go, it's all people want to talk about. I mean, it is very strange thing.
It's just the, you know, it's omnipresent, isn't it? Those things.
Yeah.
But the experience of my life is quite different. That's the...
Yeah, absolutely. And since I spoke to you last, you were part of another massive franchise in the form of Star Wars and Andor. Like, to go into that machine was... I know you've been around and done all sorts of things, but I gather that's quite a slick operation. Were you taken aback by the machinations of it?
It was very hard because it was during COVID. And so they went on with it anyway at Pinewood, and that was amazing. We wore masks until the shooting, but there's still 80 people in a room at the time that nobody else was allowed to have 80 people within 10 miles of them. And that was quite brilliantly done, brilliantly written. But the opening of it plays to your point, which is I went to Los Angeles for the opening of it. And when we drove down the street towards the cinema, there were just lines of people all dressed as, what are they, those soldier ones with the white...
Stormtroopers.
Stormtroopers. I mean, I don't know if I'd seen Star Wars. I might have seen it once in the early 80s. Stormtroopers all the way down the street, people who literally dress up as stormtroopers. That was amazing. And then there were lots of R2-D2 things going around, going... It was quite... and then you realise you're on another planet, you know, that was another planet. It was amazing, that opening, the amount of...
It's funny, Joel Edgerton was in a Star Wars movie, and he said to me, and I'm a Star Wars fan, so that's why I was asking you about it, but he said to me, Star Wars fans are crazy good and crazy. So,
there's a few crazy things. But, of course, it's a very good franchise for men. And when you've done things like Killing Eve, where so many of the fans are women, it was so lovely to be in, you know, Andor, where men just adore it. I mean, all of these stormtroopers were all guys. They weren't girls.
No, indeed.
And some of them are Darth Vaders as well. There was a lot of Darth Vaders going around like that.
Yeah, no, I know. And Liam Neeson apparently says the same thing. You know, they want to see my lightsaber, and I feel like saying to them, I was effing Oscar Schindler, for God's sake.
Yes, they don't want to see that,
Tell me this, just in closing, you mentioned Killing Eve. You seem as busy as ever and have been working more or less consistently all the way back to the 80s. You know, I don't know, you tell me, but is it easier for actors as they get older to get parts than it was 10 or 15 years ago? Because that's my sense of it.
Well, it's much easier to be the age you are and to go on being that than trying to be what you can't be. Mm. So I find this period of my life by far the most comfortable.
Well, you seem very comfortable. Happy Christmas. Yeah. And it's lovely to see you again.
Yeah, have a good Halloween too. Thanks, John.
The wonderful Fiona Shaw there wishing me a happy Christmas. She was talking to me about all sorts of things, but ostensibly and mostly about That Christmas, a new animated movie on Netflix. Up next, the co-writer of That Christmas, the wonderful Richard Curtis. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talks TV and Movie Show. Before the break, we were talking to Fiona Shaw about That Christmas. That Christmas, the new animated movie on Netflix, is based on a series of children's books by Richard Curtis, who co-wrote this, even though it was directed by Simon Otto. And this is his first foray into animation. Richard Curtis is the man who wrote things like Four Weddings and a Funeral, Notting Hill, directed things like Love Actually, as well as writing it. Yesterday, the Beatles movie, About Time, he wrote. You know, I'm a big fan of Richard Curtis. He kind of makes and writes modern romantic fairy tales and fables with plenty of sadness in it as well. It's not all holly jolly stuff. I have a huge amount of time for him. A lovely guy, a fascinating guy. And I got to talk to him about That Christmas and a bit more besides. Hi, Richard. John Fardy from News Talk Radio in Ireland. How are you?
John, very good to see you. I'm happy, feeling Christmas.
Good. Wonderful. I'm a big admirer of your work over the years, so it's a pleasure for me to talk to you.
Well, that's very sweet of you.
Tell me this, you know, if the internet's to be believed, you're 68 years of age, and yes. When people talk about you, what comes to mind is romantic comedies, boy meeting girl, and all that kind of stuff. And yet, as by your own admission, you haven't done boy meeting girl in your own life for a long time because you met the girl a good while ago. So why is it taking you so long to get to kids?
That's such a good question. I mean, it's been a slow move. So when I made my movie About Time, that was kind
of film.
That was the second half of that movie was very family, father and son, as it were. That's been creeping in. And then the film yesterday was just about Boy Meets the Beatles, which has always been my favorite subject. But that is the reason I'm so thrilled to have made this movie, really, that I'm kind of catching up. And here's a movie about the things that sort of particularly like 10 years ago used to most interest me, my young kids, the community in which we lived, you know, all of those things. So this is a much more relevant movie to me than, as you say, another Boy Meets Girl film would have been.
And as someone who's labored lovingly, but I'm sure at times it's a drag on locations and getting things done before the light comes and goes and all that kind of stuff and dealing with live people, is it like oil and water, a completely different thing to be involved in a movie that's not involving real life actors?
I mean, it has been so exciting doing it because it's really such a different process. You know, in live action movies, it's writing, casting, shooting, editing, and then those things that like a lasagna, they all happen at the same time. But particularly with the actors and this film, to make a film which features a lot of kids and to be able to bring those kids in 10 times so that they can get it perfect, so that they don't have to put up with that tension of, you know, 50 people on a crew watching them and wondering whether they're doing well. I think that's made this particularly joyful, that this is an animated film and not a live action.
Yeah. And where it takes place in this made up town, it's, and I mean this, and you're talking to an Irishman, obviously, so I have to choose my words carefully, but it's the best of Britishness, I think. It's the type of Britain I would like to go to. It's quaint. And I remember being on holidays in Cornwall thinking, this is lovely. I know it's the kind of other part of the world in Cornwall. But where were you thinking of in terms of the setting?
No, I mean, so specifically. And by the way, come and visit us. We live every day of every holidays in a town called Warbiswick, which is
right
next to Southwold, which is just south of Lowestoft. So this really is that, you know, the whole design team came up and spent a week just literally walking around our neighborhood, and everything you see is a fusion, the reeds, the lighthouse, the beach huts, all of that is stuff, that is part of our lives. So I just love the fact that the film feels like it takes place in a real place. And say it's one of the sweetest places in the UK, I think.
Yeah, lovely. Well, I will have to visit. Yeah. I spoke to Fiona a couple of weeks ago about it, and I'm repeating the same story, but I have three children, the youngest of whom is six. And I watch a lot of these things with my long-suffering wife, although she didn't suffer through this. She enjoyed it. But she said to me, I think this is too sad for Elliot, who's our six-year-old. And Fiona said, no, I don't think so. And I think she was referring to the trouble dynamic, but one of the characters and the dad being missing and stuff like that. I presume you think six is okay to watch this stuff.
I really, well, look, it's often surprising.
You're not going to cause a marital problem.
No, but
she's
you
much
know,
bigger
when,
fish
you
know, than
when you go back to kind of Grimm's fairy tales and
yeah,
the Bambi's mum dies in, you know, minute three, and the Lion King is full of all sorts of shocks and sorrows. I think it's a strange thing, but I think one of the things behind kids' entertainment has often been to introduce them to a bit of reality, to a bit of loss, and then get through it. So, I mean, we had a couple of three-year-olds watching it the other day. I don't know what they made of it. I think they probably thought it was pretty pictures, but I think you'll be safe. I don't think anyone's going to be traumatized.
No, I certainly think not. Tell me this, you know, I'm obviously cognizant of another famous Christmas movie called Love Actually. And I wonder, you know, that has become this kind of national treasure of a movie almost. And yet at the time, I think it's fair to say lukewarm reception from the critics and stuff like that. Do you look back and kind of go, F you now, and go, there's a lesson in this, like movies have a life over and above the first 3 months they're released in, or what's your take on that?
Well, I consider the Love Actually thing, the fact that people watch it every year, kind of freakish and like an extraordinary bit of luck. So I'm not sure how wrong they were, but none of us spotted the fact that I think there's something about Love Actually where you never know what scene's going to come next because there are 10 stories to choose from, that I think it makes it quite a seductive film to watch. In a normal film, you know, if they rob the bank, they're going to get into the car and drive away. But in Love Actually, you never know what's coming. So I consider myself really lucky. And those people who didn't like it, I hope they haven't been forced to watch it 27 times since its release.
I doubt it. I spoke to Kristin Scott Thomas a few years ago, and I said to her, my favorite scene in any movie I've ever seen her in, and I guess of the many scenes in your movies that stick in my mind, my favorite one is in Four Weddings and a Funeral, where she says, oh, you fool, Charlie, it's you. And yeah, she confesses to Hugh Grant she's in love with him. And I, even now thinking about it, I kind of slightly get the chills. Do you have any memory of concocting that narrative device, or was that always in your head?
I mean, it's funny you should say that. This is not going to make the cut of this interview, but the thing I'm obsessed by is I wrote that scene specially to have the words, it was you, Charlie, because those are the words that Marlon Brando says in the back of the car to Rod Steiger in On the Waterfront. So, but it was a plot that I was kind of had somewhere deep in my heart. And, you know, the great thing about my movies, it's true of this animation, having great actors like Fiona Shaw and Brian Cox, and then, you know, having an extraordinary actress like Kristen, is that I kind of write things that I hope will be fine. And then if you cast the best actors in the world, they take on all this depth. And I think that could have been a kind of, oh, it was you. But because she's got so much dignity, I remember doing it the day we did it, and how, you know, we were all kind of, there was definitely a frisson.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, listen, we're out of time. It's a real delight to see you, and my family, all of them, will be watching that Christmas, hopefully with delight. So lovely to meet you, Richard.
Well, have a very Merry Christmas, and thank you so much.
The wonderful Richard Curtis there talking to me about his long career and, of course, That Christmas, which is now on Netflix, a great Christmas kids movie that we weren't sure if we should or should not show to our six-year-old. He has subsequently watched it. He's finding it a little sad, but loving it as well. But I think it's a lovely Christmas movie. Up next, we turn to the cinema and the week's big new release, Night Bitch. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, the big new cinema release of the week is the much talked about and fascinating, certainly from the outside, because I haven't seen it, unfortunately, Night Bitch, where Amy Adams grapples with being a new mother. Delighted to be joined now by Niamh O'Reilly, movie buff and freelance journalist who has indeed seen it and is here to tell me all. Hi, Niamh, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Very well. So this is Amy Adams dealing with being a new mother and maybe it not being all she thought it might be, and then possibly turning into a dog.
Yeah, it sounds a bit crazy, but then early motherhood is a bit crazy. So this is based on Rachel Yoder's 2021 novel called Night Bitch. And yeah, it opens with Amy Adams, who is a former artist, a very successful one, would have shown her work in galleries in New York City. And she's decided to kind of pause her career to be a stay-at-home mom to her two-year-old son. And her husband is played by Scoot McNairy, who is a great character actor. You'll know him from Argo, and he was in Speak No Evil earlier this year. Now, nobody has any names in this film. So Amy Adams is just known as mother, known as husband, and the son.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, and I think that's done very deliberately to give it kind of a universal feeling, which works quite well. So we kind of open and, yeah, her son is around 2 years old and she is sort of at the very coal face of that really challenging time in motherhood. And to make matters worse, her husband is away for work. He goes away maybe 4 or 5 days on the trot, so he can be gone Monday to Friday. So she is bearing the brunt of it all. And there's some brilliant montages in this film at the beginning of kind of her days blending into one. Life with a toddler, very repetitive, the banality of it all, going to sort of parent and toddler classes and giving him his bath and his, you know, little toddler dinners and naps, and she's co-sleeping and she's not getting a lot of sleep and stuff with him. So it brings that very sort of craziness of early motherhood to life, I think, very, very well.
Yeah. And so, you know, you're a parent. I'm a man, but I'm a parent of three. You know, I think it's great, you know, on the surface, this idea of an investigation into just how strange it can be to be not just a new parent, but specifically a new mother when your life has maybe gone from a busy life of career to suddenly being at home with one or two or three kids, and it's really, really strange time. So I salute the whole idea of this movie, but it's not just that. I mean, something.
No. So there's more going on than meets the eye here. And yeah, so like the thing about this film is there's some very surreal moments in it and almost moments of like kind of dreamlike qualities to it. So in the opening of the film, she just runs into a stranger in the supermarket who says, "Oh, hey, are you that artist?" And she kind of stops and goes, you know, yeah, I was that artist. And she kind of unloads all this stuff on the stranger about, you know, how hard she finds motherhood, how tired she is, how much resentment there is there and kind of fear and how she doesn't feel like herself and all of this really heavy stuff that you would never unload on a stranger. Yeah. But then the scene changes for a second and you realize she hasn't actually said all of that. It's what she would like to say to this woman. So there's a lot of that going on in the film. We kind of, it's narrated from her perspective and we get a lot of insight into what she's thinking, but also what she would like to say. And there's some quite funny moments with Scoot McNairy in that regard, because let's just say he's not the most helpful of husbands.
I remember telling my wife not long after our first child was born, you know, take a walk today as I left to go to the office. That might do you some good. Anyway, it's not about my foibles around parenthood. Yeah. There's an element here of she's not saying this, she is saying this, it's in her head. But does she turn into a dog or what's going on there?
Yeah, so like this film has like asks a lot of questions about kind of motherhood and, you know, behind what's going on in her daily life and how difficult it is and all of the pressure that's on her and kind of the isolation that she feels, she starts to notice some kind of strange things happening. So her teeth start to get a little bit sharper. Her sense of smell goes like incredible. She's like a craving for raw meat. She notices hairs on her body. And the dogs in the neighborhood start to get very, very friendly with her. And one evening she goes out into the back garden and she changes into a dog. It's quite funny. And the film kind of plays with the darkly comic ideas, you know, but it sort of plays with trying to be a body horror as well. But I think where it falls down is that it's neither. It's not darkly funny enough to be a dark comedy, and it's not shocking enough to be like a body horror. So I felt like it posed all these big questions about motherhood and kind of the primal side of being pregnant and giving birth and sort of the powerful nature of that, and how women maybe lose a sense of identity when they become a mom. And, you know, is it really that crazy to think of yourself turning into a dog at night? You know, maybe not.
And so you're saying in unfortunately, this maybe falls between two stools.
Yeah, I feel like it does. Like it asks a lot of great questions, and it is wonderful to see so much relatability up there on the big screen. Yeah. Like there's one part in particular where Scoot McNairy's character, he comes home after being away for like 5 days on the trot, and he sort of says some really silly remark to her, like, you know, I'd kill to stay at home every day with her son, you know. And by this point, she hasn't had a shower in 4 days. She hasn't slept in 4 days. So there's a lot of relatability there. And she kind of says to him, okay, well, you know, go ahead, you know, you take over. And he spends the whole time like asking her, where's this? Where's that? Can you bring me the sippy cup? All this sort of stuff while he's in sitting on the toilet looking at his phone, you know. So there's quite a level of frustration there in their relationship, which I think is very, very relatable.
Amy Adams is getting plaudits for this. How did you find her performance?
She is terrific in this, and it's very, she really puts herself out there, I think, in a physical sense as well. And like turning into a dog is something that could be, it could look a bit silly. Do you know what I mean? Like she is digging in the dirt and that sort of thing, but she pulls it off because she's such a good quality actress. And she really is the best thing about this. And it is very relatable. And I think mums in particular will probably get a lot out of this. I think maybe new dads might like to go and see this as well. But where it fell down for me was that it didn't follow through on any of these kind of bolder, darker questions that it was posing about motherhood. And sort of towards the end, it just went for a kind of a Hollywood ending, which I just felt it lost its relatability at that point, because real life isn't really like that. And real motherhood is messier than that. So I felt like they didn't go for the jugular maybe when they could have.
Okay, because it sounds like, as you describe it, a fascinating kind of investigation and a really interesting idea of, you know, the dog-like nature of being a new mother nearly, but it just went a bit Hollywood and isn't quite sure what it is. So what are you going to say stars-wise for Night Bitch?
I'm going to say 3 stars. You know, it's still, I think it's great to see motherhood up on the big screen in a mainstream way, because I think it's very underrepresented, and great that someone like Amy Adams is making a film like this that could have otherwise been a very art house flick. So a solid 3, a strong 3, as I would say. But it just, it felt like she was defanged a little bit, and the story maybe ended up chasing its tail.
Whoa, my God. Wow. That's very well put. All those dog analogies. That's impressive. That's why we pay her the big bucks. Niamh O'Reilly gives Night Bitch, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 6th of December. She gives it 3 stars. Sounds fascinating, but I'm going to have to see it for myself. But in the meantime, trust in Niamh, who says it's 3 stars. Niamh, thanks a million.
Thank you.
He's super cute.
Do you just love getting to be home with him all the time?
Yeah, I do. I love it. You're an artist, right?
Well, I used to be.
Oh, wow.
But that feels like a lifetime ago. So
Totally. Definitely.
We get it. I used to be a stripper.
The before times.
Nobody in this family can clean their own butts.
No.
If you wake him up,
I will rip your throat out.
Okay, for what it's worth. I would kill to stay home with him every day.
Peel off. Look at my teeth. See how sharp they are?
It's a little bit weird.
Motherhood. It changes you. It connects you to some primal urges.
I feel like I'm stuck.
Make up a plan, draw up a schedule. Happiness is a choice. Happiness is a choice.
I'll try.
I'm never going to be smart, happy, or thin. Ever again.
Oh, and I'm pretty sure I'm turning into a doll.
You're so funny.
A clip there from Night Bitch, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 6th of December. Sounds like a fascinating movie, if not entirely successful. Very interesting, and one I'm going to have to check out. I did interview Amy Adams a few years ago for Hillbilly Elegy. You can find that interview and so many more with big Hollywood stars by listening back to any of the previous shows, which are all available to podcast on the News Talk app powered by Go Loud. This show itself is available every Friday at 5 p.m. on News Talk. Talk.com or the News Talk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. If you want to get in touch with me at any stage, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Thank you for listening, and I will talk to you all next week.
Whether you're making the same breakfast that you have every day or baking a cake for an extra special day, eggs are a staple in our diets. Eggland's Best eggs are nutritionally superior to ordinary eggs, containing more vitamins and 25% less saturated fat. Not only are they better for you, but Eggland's Best eggs taste better too. There's a reason that they're America's number one eggs. Visit egglandsbest.com for additional information and delicious recipes.